Okay, let's unpack this. Usually, when we sit down to do a deep dive, we are looking at something. Well, something static, right?
Right.
We have a history book, a scientific paper, a finished novel, the ink is dry, the facts are, the facts, and we just have to organize them.
Exactly. You're usually acting as an archaeologist. You're
Yeah.
dusting off bones that are already in the ground. The story is over.
But today is, it's different. I have in front of me a stack of papers that feels, well, it feels unstable.
Unstable is a good word for it.
I'm looking at session notes, frantic scribbles about cheese cults, detailed metaphysical maps of a city called Concordance that apparently doesn't stay in one shape for more than a day, and this massive document, which is ominously titled The Bible, version of four.
Version 4, which, immediately implies the existence and likely the catastrophic failure of versions 1 through 3.
That is the terrifying part. It's not a finished story. We are looking at a narrative that is literally rewriting itself as we try to read it. This is the Twilight Enclave campaign. And our mission today, our whole goal, is to take this absolute archive of chaos and figure out what is actually true.
A single coherent timeline, if one even exists.
Because depending on which document you read in this stack, the main characters are either heroes, terrorists, or they're already dead.
And that ambiguity is the point. I really think it is. This isn't just a standard Dungeons and Dragons adventure where you kill the dragon and get the gold.
No.
When you really dig into the Ancient of Mu Mu records and the Dungeon Master's private lore notes, you realize this is a story about control
Control of what?
of everything.
Right.
Specifically, who gets to decide what reality is allowed to become?
That is a very heavy philosophical question for a story that, and I'm looking at the first page of notes here, starts with rats in a basement.
It really does start there, doesn't it? But
Yeah.
even the rats, as absurd as they are, they're a symptom of the bigger problem, their chaos.
Okay, so let's try to give you a roadmap. We're going to track this story from that inciting incident in Sigil, the City of Doors, through the shifting, unstable city of Concordance, then down into what I can only describe as Lovecraftian horror.
Avoid, yes.
And we're going to end up at the current cliffhanger, which is, frankly, it's
It's
baffling.
apocalyptic. It genuinely is.
Right. So let's go back to the beginning, part one, the inciting incident. We're in Sigil. Now, for anyone listening who isn't steeped in this stuff, we need to paint a picture. What is Sigil? Because this isn't just some medieval village.
No, absolutely not. Sigil is often called the City of Doors. The easiest way to picture it is to imagine a city built on the inside of a giant floating tire of Taurus.
So it curves up.
It curves up infinitely, hovering impossibly high above a spire that sits at the very center of the multiverse. It is the crossroads of all existence.
So if you look up from the street, you're not seeing sky, you're seeing more city. The other side of the tire.
Exactly. And because it sits at the center of all the planes, it connects to everywhere. There are portals and random alleyways that could lead to heaven or hell or a plane made entirely of fire.
So you'll see demons walking down the street next to angels.
And neither of them can start a fight. It's crowded, it's smoggy. It has a very distinct sort of cyberpunk meets fantasy aesthetic. And crucially, it is ruled by the Lady of Pain.
The Lady of Pain, I love that name. She's this enigmatic entity that keeps the gods out, right?
Correct. She enforces a kind of brutal neutrality. She's the reason the eternal blood war between demons and devils doesn't just spill into the streets and consume the multiverse. Her will is absolute.
Okay, so in this city where literally anything can happen, where do we start? We zoom in on a basement.
The basement of a restaurant called the Balance Scale.
And this is where we meet our cast of characters. T goes, Genesis, LT, and Tebby, and Set, who also goes by Gizmol, they wake up with what? Partial memory loss.
Total memory loss.
Yeah.
It's the classic hangover trope, yes. They have no idea how they got there. But the immediate threat isn't the headache or the missing memories, it's the chanting.
A low chanting. And the notes here say, Raxputin.
Yes. Ratsputin.
Please tell me this isn't just a pun. I need to know.
It is a pun, but it's a pun with psionic powers. It's a dangerous one. They find a cult of rats in the basement.
A cult of
But
rats.
these aren't your standard sewer vermin. The source text is very specific. They're cranium rats.
Okay, for the listener who might not be deep into the monster manual, what makes a cranium rat different from a regular rat? What's the deal?
Well, a normal rat, it bites your ankle and maybe gives you a disease.
Right.
A cranium rat is a biological drone that was originally created by mind flayers, the Illithids.
Oh, the tentacle-faced brain eaters, of
Yes,
course.
those guys. Their brains are exposed. They're literally pulsing with pinkish light. And the scary part is, when they gather in a swarm, They form a hive mind.
So they get smarter the more of them there are.
Exponentially smarter. A single rat is just a nuisance, but a swarm. A swarm becomes a wizard. They gain intelligence. They can cast spells.
And this particular swarm of psionic super rats calls itself
Ratsputin, the avatar of the cheese god.
The cheese god.
They're in the middle of a ritual to summon, one assumes, some sort of divine dairy product. Now, look at how the party handles this. This is our first real data point on their psychology. This is who they are.
I'm looking at the session log. It's a very short plan. It just says, Plan A, drive the rats upstairs.
Into the main dining room.
During peak dinner service.
This is a crucial piece of context. Sigil is a city of factions and strict unwritten laws. You don't just cause a scene, it's bad for business, and it can get you killed, or worse, mazed by the Lady of Pain.
And this group, their first instinct is to weaponize chaos.
Immediately. They don't try to negotiate, they don't try to sneak past, they drive a swarm of psionic cheese-worshipping rats into a room full of paying customers.
It's objectively hilarious, I have to admit. But you're right, it sets a tone. They aren't heroes. They're not even anti-heroes, really. They're just agents of chaos.
Problem causers, which is exactly why they get hired. Out of the chaos, two figures emerge, Lysandra and Meridian.
Meridian owns the restaurant, which is now presumably covered in rat fur and existential panic, and Lysandra is.
Well, she's hard to pin down in the notes. She's described as an observer, a fixer.
She's the quest giver. She sees this group of chaotic, effective, and frankly disposable individuals and thinks, perfect. She offers them a job.
Get out of town. We'll pay you. We'll clear your debt for the damages. Just go.
Go to the Twilight Enclave. Deliver a simple package, a deck of cards, to a guy named Thad.
It sounds like a simple courier run. Easy money. Here's a box. Take it to Thad. But this is where the Bible version 4 document reveals the first major deception, the first, you know, rewrite of reality for the group.
The deck.
The party thinks they're carrying the deck of many things.
Which, for those who don't know the D&D lore, is basically the nuclear bomb of magic items. Explain that.
It's an artifact of pure, unadulterated chaos. You draw a card, you might gain a castle, you might learn the answer to your life's biggest question. Or your soul might get sucked into a gem held by a demon 1,000 miles away.
High risk, high reward.
The highest. It is pure randomness. It's the ultimate gambler's high. And it can break a campaign in 5 minutes.
And the party's excited about this. They're carrying a nuke in their pocket. They are probably already planning what they're going to do with their wishes. But the notes say Lysandra swapped it.
She did.
Yeah.
A perfect sleight of hand. She kept the real artifact, which we later learn is described as a mortal override device for reality governance, a very scary concept we will get to later, and she replaced it with something else.
A deck of fates.
A deck of fates.
That sounds similar. Is it just a knockoff brand? Like you get a small cottage instead of a castle?
It's legally distinct, and it's functionally the opposite. The deck of many things is chaos. The deck of fates is law. It's order. It's a binding contract disguised as a game of chance.
So they leave Sigil, thinking they are chaos agents, carrying a briefcase full of chaos, but they are actually carrying a briefcase full of handcuffs.
Beautifully put. That is exactly it. They travel to the Twilight Enclave, specifically to the City of Concordance. And when they arrive, they go to meet their contact.
But Thad isn't there. He's missing. Instead, they meet his partner, a man named Brandon.
At a place called the Tavern of Three Truths.
I want to pause on the visuals of Concordance in a minute, but we have to talk about the trap, because this is the moment the campaign stops being a job and becomes a curse.
Right, because Brandon is acting strange. The notes say he is compelled, he's being magically influenced.
By Lysandra.
By Lysandra. She's pulling his strings from afar, he offers them a drink, seems friendly, and then he says, Thad said you might want to draw a card for luck. He tricks the party into using the deck.
And Tigos. Halfling rogue. Hey, you can just see it coming, can't you?
Oh, it's inevitable. Impulsive, greedy Tigos. He doesn't wait to check for traps. He doesn't cast identify to see what the magic item does. He just hears, draw a card, and his hand is already moving. He draws.
Snap. The trap shuts.
This is where the mechanics of the deck of fates kick in. The effect isn't you win 50 gold or an ogre appears.
No.
The effect is you are now geased. You are magically bound to a destiny. You have signed a contract.
The card isn't a reward, it's a signature.
Exactly. By drawing, Tigas binds the entire group, because they were hired as a group, to a specific narrative path.
What's the path?
Find Thad and discover the truth. They physically cannot abandon the mission now. If they try to leave the city, the magic will compel them to turn around and come back. If they try to do anything else, they'll suffer psychic damage.
That is terrifying. It completely removes player agency in a way that feels very meta. There are characters in a story who have just been forced to read the script, whether they like it or not.
And that is the core theme of the Enclave and Lysandra's whole deal. Control, they are now puppets. But they're puppets with knives and fireballs, which is always dangerous.
So they are stuck in Concordance. Let's talk about Concordance now, because the notes describe the city in a way that just, it hurts my brain. It's not just one style of architecture.
No. Concordance is a city at war with its own existence. Visually, it is split three ways. You have districts that look like ancient Greece white marble, columns, a heavy emphasis on the goddess Athena.
Okay.
Then, right next door, you'll have districts that look like ancient Egypt, sandstone, obelisks, grand statues, all showing the influence of the god Set.
Order versus chaos, basically.
Basically. And then squeezed in between, almost like a buffer zone, you have the original architecture of the city Germanic or Norse longhouses, timber and stone. These are the Twilight folk, the original inhabitants.
But it's not just distinct neighborhoods like, you know, Chinatown or Little Italy in a normal city, right? The sources say the buildings literally change overnight.
Exactly. This is the reality bleed. It's not just decoration. It's a symptom of a much larger problem. The Enclave was supposed to be neutral territory, governed by a non-interference pact.
Like a demilitarized zone for gods.
Precisely. A Cold War truce between pantheons. They could be worshipped here, but they couldn't directly interfere. But that pact is failing. The gods are bleeding through.
So if Athena's faction gains a little more power on a Tuesday,
a Germanic longhouse literally morphs into a Greek temple by Wednesday morning. The very fabric of reality is unstable.
Imagine waking up and your bedroom has turned into a dusty crypt because Set had a particularly good week.
That is the daily reality for the citizens of Concordance. And into this metaphysical mess walks our party, contractually obligated to find a missing person.
So they have to start investigating. Where do they begin?
Well, Tigos and LT decide to go to a Greek temple. We want to do a little divination, maybe sacrifice a pig, ask Athena for a clue about where Sat is. You know, standard D&D stuff.
Seems reasonable.
But then the sky rips open. This is a crucial data point from the Bible document. The augury, the ritual, it goes catastrophically wrong. Instead of a simple vision saying Thad is in the sewers, they get a direct divine proclamation.
From who? Athena.
It's not clear. A voice just booms down from the heavens and it points at Tigos. And it says he will bring about the destruction of all existence.
Whoa. Okay, hold on. Let's parse that. Destruction of all existence. Not just the city, not just the world. Existence.
That is the exact wording from the notes.
Okay.
And this moment, it completely reframes Tigos. He's not just a sneaky rogue anymore. He's a walking time bomb, or perhaps a catalyst for something much, much older.
And this raises a fascinating question about prophecy, doesn't it?
Oh, I know where you're going with this. Is it the Oedipus problem?
Exactly. Is this prophecy descriptive or prescriptive? Is Tigos destined to destroy the world because that is his fundamental nature?
Or by telling him he will destroy the world, does the universe now ensure that he takes the specific actions that will lead to it?
It's the classic self-fulfilling prophecy. If you tell a chaotic little rogue he's going to break the world, he might just think, well, I guess I better get started.
Or he might try so desperately hard to prevent it that he accidentally causes it. That's the real tragedy of those stories. But while Tigos is grappling with, you know, suddenly being the potential Antichrist, the rest of the party is finding actual clues.
Right. They're doing the legwork. Genesis, the Warforged, finds out from an Egyptian witch that Thad is likely dead and that he was involved in something deep underground.
They eventually regroup, put the clues together, and head to the sewers. They fight some gelatinous cubes, as you do, and they find a hidden portal hub, a place called the Cave of Echoes.
This cave becomes their base of operations, right?
It's very important because it seems to sit outside the normal geography of the shifting city. It's a stable point. It allows them to bypass the reality, bleeds on the surface. It's like a back door in the code of the city.
And it leads into the body.
It leads them to Thad. They find him behind a waterfall. And he's not just dead. He's wrong.
He's mummified, desiccated. But the notes say he's only been missing for a couple of weeks.
Right. And it's not the dry desert air of the Egyptian district that did it. The forensic detail here is key. He was killed by a temporal parasite.
A time bug.
Essentially. Something that latched onto him and drained the time out of his body. It didn't drain his blood. It drained his future. It accelerated his biological clock until he was dust, all in a matter of seconds.
That is horrifying.
It is, and it is our first concrete clue that the weapon being used in the secret war isn't just swords or magic missiles, it's time itself.
Which leads us perfectly into part three, the garden. Because if you're dealing with time weirdness, you go to the place where time is officially deliberately broken.
The Eternal Garden, a pocket dimension that they can access using a key they found on Thad's body.
The time dilation here is just nuts. What is it, one day inside the garden equals 1 year outside?
Correct. One 24-hour cycle in the garden and 365 days pass in concordance.
I mean, think about the economic utility of that for a moment. Thad wasn't just a smuggler of goods. He was an arbitrager of time.
Oh, right. I didn't think about that. You put a young wine or a wheel of cheese in the garden, wait a day, and you pull out a perfectly aged vintage product.
Exactly. He could age whiskey 20 years in just under 3 weeks. It's a brilliant business model. Unethical, probably. Violates all sorts of trade laws, but brilliant. But he wasn't just aging cheese, was he? That was a cover.
No, not at all. Thad was an agent. He was working for the gardener, an archfey, who rules this pocket dimension. Thad was using the smuggling operation as a cover to investigate the reality bleeds in concordance for his boss.
And this is where we see just how ruthless Lysandra, the woman who hired our party in the first place, really is.
Yes.
Yeah.
The party finds a letter Thad was supposed to deliver to the gardener. Lysandra gave it to him.
And it's a trap.
It's a magical booby trap. A glyph of warding, a curse. It was intended to kill the gardener the moment he opened it. She tried to use Thad to assassinate an archfey just to silence him.
Because the gardener knew too much.
Because the gardener exists outside the normal flow of time. He sees the timeline differently. Lysandra is trying to control the narrative, and the gardener was a loose end, a witness she couldn't allow to exist.
But Thad didn't deliver the letter. He died in the Cave of Echoes before he could.
Correct. So the party inadvertently saves the gardener and reveals Lysandra's betrayal. But let's get to the core of it. What did Thad find? Why did he have to die? This is the core mystery, the ancient evil lurking beneath the entire investigation.
The caverns of Thracia.
Right. Thad had led an expedition deep, deep down, below Concordance, past the Greek ruins, past the Egyptian layers, down to something much, much older, a place called the Temple of Balance.
This sounds like the place where that non-interference pact was originally signed.
It is. It's a pre-Pantheon site, a place of power from a time before the gods who are currently fighting over the surface even existed.
And Thad, he broke something.
He broke the seal.
Oops.
Oops is the understatement of the century. By breaking the seal, he didn't just let a monster out. He disturbed the entities from outside.
Outside of what?
Outside of reality. Outside the multiverse. We have names for them in the source text. The Mask, which is described as a herald, a sort of scout. And the big one, Azothos.
Azothos. That sounds Lovecraftian.
It is entirely Lovecraftian. The source describes Azothos as a reality-eating entity that exists outside the multiverse. This isn't a demon or a devil with goals and motivations. It is something that looks at the very concept of existence and sees food.
So let me get this straight. You have Athena and Set fighting over who gets to decorate the city. You have Lysandra playing 4D chess with a cursed deck of cards. And underneath all of them, there is a cosmic horror waking up that wants to eat the board, the pieces, and the players.
Precisely. And the reality bleed in the city, the shifting buildings. That isn't just the gods fighting anymore.
Right.
That is the universe itself fracturing because the seal is broken. The foundations are cracking.
And Thaddeus was killed because he knew this. He found out the truth was so much bigger and scarier than just local politics.
Exactly. He wasn't killed by Set's agents or Athena's. He was killed by a temporal parasite because he got too close to the void.
Okay, that raises the stakes significantly. It's not a city dispute anymore. It's a survival horror story. But just as the party starts to figure this out, they get grabbed by yet another faction.
The board gets even more crowded.
Part four, the Syndicate.
Enter Captain Valen, who also goes by the name Seraph.
I love her vibe. The visuals in the notes for her are great. Red hair, an eye patch. She sits in a peacock chair. Her headquarters is a Roman villa floating in the astral sea. She's like a Bond villain who decided to take over a D&D campaign.
She runs the Thieves Guild, but that is a complete misnomer. This is a Spelljammer crime syndicate.
Okay, we need to pause on Spelljammer. For any listener who thinks D&D is just horses and carts, what is Spelljammer?
Think Treasure Planet or Master and Commander in space. It is D&D's version of science fantasy. It involves magical ships that can sail on solar winds through the phlogiston or the astral sea.
So they fly between planets, between different fantasy worlds.
Exactly. It changes the genre completely. Suddenly, we aren't just on a single planet. We are in a universe where you can sail your galleon to other worlds.
And Velin is a crime lord of this space sector.
She operates across the planes. She's a major power player. And she hires, and I'm using very heavy air quotes around, hires the party.
By which you mean she captures them and coerces them.
Correct. This leads to the second contract.
Just when they thought they were getting out from under the first one.
And this one is so much worse. Genesis, the Warforged Warlock, has the legal knowledge to analyze it. And the notes say she has this oh crap moment.
Why? What's in it?
This contract doesn't just bind them to service. It claims ownership of their souls. It binds them even past death. Worse, it even claims their connections to their warlock patrons.
Wait, it can do that? It can sever a warlock's link to their patron.
It seems Velin has found a piece of infernal legalese that allows her to insert the syndicate as a middleman. Genesis realizes that Velin has found a loophole to essentially steal her power source. It's bureaucratic horror at its finest. You can't even die to get out of it.
That is just chilling. So what does Velin want from them?
She doesn't care about the cheese god or the politics of Concordance. She wants what Thad found. She knows a seal was broken, and she wants to harness that outside energy, the void energy.
To do what?
To sink it with her ship's helm. Her ship is a nautiloid, a mind flayer vessel called the Abyssal Choir.
The Abyssal Choir, which is a fantastic name for a spooky ship.
Yes. She wants to navigate the ethereal ocean using this forbidden reality warping energy. But she needs a conduit, someone, or something to bridge the gap. So she tries to run a sync experiment using Entebbe.
Why Entebbe? What makes him special?
This is where the meta-narrative gets really wild. The sources describe Entebbe as being from core Earth or infinite Earths.
So, from our world. The real world.
It's implied he's an anomaly. He exists paradoxically within the campaign setting. He is, in a way, just as outside as the monsters from the void. He's a glitch.
He's a glitch in the Matrix.
Effectively. He doesn't truly belong in this reality. So Velin thinks, perfect. He can handle the void energy. He's already halfway there.
Does it work?
It fails catastrophically. Mm-hmm. When they try to plug him into the ship's engine, reality itself seems to reject the connection. The ship's helm shatters. The engines overload.
The ship breaks down. It's grounded for repairs. And while Velin is fuming and trying to fix her space engine, the party sees their chance. Part 5, The Great Escape.
They know something Velin doesn't.
The Cave of Echoes.
Exactly. Velin captured them on the surface. She has no idea they have a secret, stable portal hub under the city.
So while the Abyssal Choir is stuck in dry dock, they sneak away, find a portal in a tavern basement that connects to their network, and gate directly back to Sigil. Boom. Gone. They pulled a Houdini.
A clean escape. Physically, at least. But escaping physically doesn't break the soul contract.
Oh.
They are technically still employees of the syndicate, now AWOL. Velin is absolutely hunting them. Lysandra is still watching them. The void is waking up beneath them. They're running out of safe places to hide.
So they go to ground. They hide in a slum in Sigil, just trying to catch their breath. And this leads to one of the most surreal sequences in the logs, the Cloud Tea House dream.
This is a shared hallucination, or perhaps a divine visitation. The whole party shares a collective dream where they are in a tea house made of clouds. It's this moment of quiet stillness, but it's loaded with foreshadowing.
The notes say each character is shown a secret.
Yes, which the source text teases but keeps mysterious. But the most important thing happens to Entebbe, the anomaly.
The contract on the arm.
A dream entity, which is posing as an officer of the Harmonium, the Sigil police force. It brands a new contract directly onto Entebbe's skin.
Ouch. Another contract.
Yes, but this one seems different. It gives him a key, a physical key that he has when he wakes up. And it gives him a warning. Just four words. Run. They have found you.
They. That is just so ominous. Who is they?
And that's the question, isn't it? Is it the Syndicate? Is it the Harmonium for real this time? Is it the agents of the gods from Concordance? Or is it the Void?
Well, we find out pretty quickly when they wake up. Part 6, The Current Crisis. They wake up in their hideout in Sigil, and they are immediately attacked. But not by space pirates.
No, not by law enforcement either. They're attacked by void entities. Black, amorphous blobs from outside. Things that shouldn't exist.
And there's this weird detail I want to highlight. Genesis, the Warforged, has a teapot. Just a random teapot she carries around. And it starts boiling over with black ooze when these things show up.
It reacts to the void. It's a proximity warning system. It suggests that even the mundane items the party carries are becoming infected or connected to this cosmic threat. The corruption is spreading to their inventory sheet.
So they're cornered in this slum, void monsters are pouring in, and Tebby has this mysterious dream key. He uses it on a random chest in the room, because why not?
In desperation, yeah.
And it opens a portal into pure blackness. They jump through.
Out of the frying pan.
Fine and into the apocalypse. They step through the portal, and they are back at the edge of Concordance. But it's not the shifting, living city they left.
It's a ruin. It's burned out. Destroyed. The architecture isn't fighting anymore because it's all just rubble and ash.
And the most chilling part, the time jump, the notes are explicit. They are in the future.
Which brings us right back to the beginning. Right back to Tigosa's prophecy in that Greek temple.
Yeah.
You will bring about the destruction of all existence. They are standing in the wreckage.
So what does this all mean then? Synthesizing all these chaotic sources, did they fail? Is this the inevitable outcome that was always going to happen?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the theme we started with, it confirms the stakes. That struggle for reality,
yeah,
it's been lost. At least this round has. The void, or entropy, or azothos, whatever you want to call it, has won. The party isn't trying to prevent an apocalypse anymore. They are standing in the aftermath of it.
That is one heck of a cliffhanger to end a session on.
It's brutal. It recontextualizes their entire journey. They weren't preventing a disaster. They were just running from it. And now they've landed at the finish line, and it's a graveyard.
Okay, so let's synthesize the truth here. We promised a definitive account. If you're listening, this is the board state as of Bible version 4.
The current awful truth.
One, the party is trapped in a ruined future where Concordance has been completely destroyed. They don't know when they are exactly. A year? A century?
Two, they still have a soul contract binding them to a spelljammer crime lord who is undoubtedly still hunting them, even across time. She doesn't seem like the type to let a grudge go.
No. Three, they have that other contract, the Deck of Fates, still binding them to find the truth about a murder they have essentially already solved. Thad was killed by a time parasite because he let the void out.
Which feels like a cruel joke at this point. And four, the void entities, the actual agents of the destruction, are actively pursuing them. They followed them from Sigil.
So they're trapped, hunted by multiple factions, and standing in the ruins of the problem they were supposed to fix. It seems hopeless.
Almost. But five, they might have the tools to fix it. They have the Cave of Echoes, which connects to different times and places. It might be their only way back. They have the knowledge from Bible V4, effectively. They know what broke the world. The question is, can they use their temporal keys to go back and undo it?
Or, and here's the thought that just keeps nagging me, reading all this. If they go back and try to fix it, are they just fulfilling the loop?
That is the classic tragedy of Greek myth, isn't it? Very fitting for a campaign that started with Athena and prophecies. If Tigaz goes back in time to try and stop the destruction, is that very action the thing that causes the destruction?
They could be the architects of their own apocalypse. They might be the ones who light the match.
It is a terrifying possibility. But that is the nature of a living story like this one. Until the dice are rolled, the future, even a ruined one, is just a draft. It's not canon yet.
Well, on that cheerful note, it sounds like the Bible version 4 is less of a history book and more of a warning label.
It's a warning label on a bottle of poison that has already been drunk.
Yeah.
Now they just have to find the antidote.
Exactly. So, for you, our learner listening to this, you now have the definitive truth of the Twilight Enclave campaign up to this moment. You know about the rats, the decks, the contracts, and the ruins.
You're all caught up.
The rest? Well, the rest is still being written. And rewritten. Thanks for diving deep with us. Keep your eyes on the shadows and maybe check your teapots for black ooze. We'll see you in the next timeline.